in front of me. One, a listener in New Orleans sent me about what actually gets called at a jam session where she is. And I've got Bill Bailey, Pennies from Heaven, After You're Gone, Someday Sweetheart. Half of it reads like the back end of an original Dixieland jazz band record. On the other list, I've got what gets called here in Northern Canada. I've got Beautiful Love, All the Things You Are, Moanin', There Will Be Never Be Another You. So it's the same genre, it's jazz, and it's the same word, that's standard. There's almost no overlap. And that's when it hit me that a jam session's repertoire is basically a fingerprint. It tells you where you are and who you're playing with before anyone says a word. I went looking for a tune that didn't show up on either list, something real enough to be sitting in the real book, famous enough that a player would recognize it, but obscure enough that I've never heard it called at any jam, or as far as I can tell, not in New Orleans either. I found it in the C section. That's three tunes down from Ciora. I'm Joanna Aline, and this is The Standard Show. Every week, I take one tune from the real book and spend an hour finding out where it came from, who made it famous, who built it, who rebuilt it, and why it has survived so long. This week, you're listening to Central Park West, John Coltrane's tenor ballad, hiding one of the most quietly restless chord cycles he ever wrote, recorded in the same handful of days as My Favorite Things on an instrument he'd owned for only about 7 months. I've got those recordings tonight that span more than 60 years, and by the end I want to talk to you about what it means that the book that everyone reads from doesn't care what gets called at your jam. A note before I get into it, Coltrane wrote this as a pure instrumental. There was never an original lyric. We're going to spend time with the question those two lists actually raise. Someone did eventually write words for this tune, it's decades later, and we'll get into that version later in the hour. So, same jazz, same structure, totally different lists. John William Coltrane was born September 23rd of 1926 in Hamlet, North Carolina, and grew up mostly in High Point, in a household built around two ministers. In late 38 and 39, within a few months of each other, his grandfather and his grandmother, his aunt and his father all died. He was 12 years old, and the family that was left, his mother and his cousin Mary, held on for a few more years before moving to Philadelphia in 1943, chasing the same post-war migration north that reshaped a whole generation of black families from the Carolinas. It was in Philadelphia as a teenager that his mother brought him his first saxophone, an alto, and it was there that he started down the path that ran through a stint in the Navy, Philadelphia Club, sideman work with Dizzy Gillespie, Eddie Clearhead Vinson, Earl Bostic, and Johnny Hodges, and finally, in 1955, into Miles Davis's new quintet alongside Red Garland, Paul Chambers, and Philly Joe Jones. Coltrane had been using heroin for years by 1955, and by 1957 it had gotten bad enough, and that's missed sets, unreliable nights, that Davis let him go. That spring, by his own later account, Coltrane locked himself in a room in his mother's house in Philadelphia and got clean cold turkey, an experience he would describe a few years later in the liner notes to A Love Supreme as a spiritual awakening that changed the direction of his whole life. That August, newly sober and recently married to Naima Grubbs, he moved the two of them and her young daughter, Saida, into an apartment near 103rd Street and Amsterdam Avenue, close enough to Central Park West that the street itself became part of his daily geography. It was a route he walked rather than just an address he had. Davis brought him back into the band in January of 1958, and Coltrane spent that year working through that group's repertoire, beginning the sessions that would eventually become Kind of Blue. But by early 1959, he was outgrowing a role as simply a sideman. That May, in between Miles Davis dates, he brought his own band to Atlantic Studio and recorded Giant Steps. With it, he introduced the rest of the jazz world to what would be eventually called Coltrane Changes. Coltrane changes are a symmetrical division of the octave into three keys, each a major third apart, cycled through at a clip fast enough that generations of saxophone students still practice this tune as an endurance exercise before they even consider improvising over it. Central Park West, recorded a year and a half later, on October 24, 1960, takes that same underlying idea somewhere almost nobody expected, and that's into a ballad. Instead of three keys, a major third apart, Coltrane divides the octaves into four, a minor third apart. That's B, D, F, and A flat. He doesn't even use that order straight through. He reshuffles the cycle to B, D, A flat, F, and then back to B. So the harmony alternates between minor third jumps and tritone jumps rather than just settling into the predictable ladder that Giant Steps climbs. The result is a Berner's harmonic logic, but it's played as a whisper. The form itself is just 10 bars, which is unusually short, even by the compressed standards jazz forms tend towards, which means the harmonic round keeps shifting under the melody that never once picks up speed to match it. It's the same mathematical instinct that drives Giant Steps, applied to a completely different emotional register. The soprano saxophone on this recording was still new to him. Miles Davis had bought Coltrane a straight soprano while the two of them were on a European tour that March, an instrument that had all but vanished from modern jazz since Sidney Bechet's era, with the notable exception of Steve Lacy. Coltrane debuted on a record that June, on a session alongside Ornette Coleman's rhythm section, and that's Don Cherry, Charlie Hayden, and Ed Blackwell. By October, he was using the soprano as his primary voice across an entire run of new material recorded in that single productive week. My Favorite Things, Equinox, 26-2, and Central Park West itself. The one and only of that batch that was built as a ballad rather than a burner, and the only one named for the street that he'd been living a few blocks from since the year he got his life back. I think that's important. This is not a nostalgic postcard written from a distance, the way a lot of place name standards work, like Autumn in New York, Manhattan, the whole genre songs about a city that someone's missing. Coltrane wrote this one from inside the neighborhood, at a moment in his life where just being able to live there, to be sober and steady with a family life around him, was an achievement. The harmony is restless, but the occasion, as far as anyone can tell, was not. There are two ways at looking at the composition and the background of this tune. One is purely technical. That's symmetrical octave divisions, minor thirds, tritone substitutions. And that version is totally true, and it's also a little incomplete. I think the emotional side of this composition is the story of a guy who almost died of addiction 3 years earlier, walking distance from Central Park for the first time in his adult life, choosing to spend some of that stability writing the hardest ballads he'd ever attempt. And both things are happening at the same time in the same 10 bars. You can't actually separate them once you know that they're there. Let's go back to those two set lists from jam sessions. The New Orleans list that has Bill Bailey, I Can't Give You Anything But Love, I'm Confessing That I Love You After You're Gone. It's mostly pop songs from the tail end of the 1910s through the 1920s, the exact window when the original Dixieland Jazz Band was cutting the first jazz records anyone ever bought, and a wave of Tin Pan Alley writers were feeding tunes straight into that new dance band market. That repertoire didn't survive in New Orleans because musicologists decided 100 years later that it was important. It survived because it kept getting called night after night in rooms built around a tourism economy and a brass into jazz lineage that never stopped running. The city turned those tunes into muscle memory generations before anyone thought to write a book about it. Worth remembering is that the original Dixieland Jazz Band itself is a group of white New Orleans musicians in segregation who made the first jazz records in history in 1917. They're playing music built on innovations from black musicians in the same city who are not given the same recording opportunities. The tune list survives regardless of who first got credit for it, with its own reminder that the repertoire's survival and the repertoire's fair credit have never been the same question. And then my local Yardbird list, Beautiful Love, All the Things You Are, Moanin', There Will Never Be Another You. It comes from somewhere else entirely. Bebop and hard bop material, the kind of tunes that reward a rhythm section and an improviser rather than a dance floor. That's no accident either. This city has a decades-deep big band and dance hall tradition behind it, touring bands passing through for most of the 20th century, and then this specific room, the Yardbird Suite. It's closing in on 70 years of continuous operation now, has spent most of its run as a listening room built for exactly this kind of vehicle, not a ballroom. The tunes that get called here on a Tuesday reflect that whole history, the same way the New Orleans list reflects that city's history. Neither list is really about the songs. It's all about the culture and the rooms. And neither list is written down anywhere before I wrote it down. That's the part that stuck with me. For most of jazz history, the repertoire survived the way folk material always survives, and that's person to person, mouth to mouth, gig to gig, inside one specific room until everyone who plays there knows it. The way you know the words to a song you never chose to memorize. Then, in the mid-70s, two students at the Berklee College of Music put together an illegal fake book at a local copy shop. Several hundred lead sheets bound and pressed hand-to-hand, entirely unauthorized, and it quickly became the reference room every working musician was expected to own. Hal Leonard didn't release a legal version of it till 2004, so what's fixed on those pages wasn't chosen because it was more important than what got left off. It was chosen because it was in two students' record collections. It's a place and time and a city. Their teachers built record collections in Boston in the 70s. The real book didn't document a canon that already existed. It made one out of whatever happened to be in the room when the copier was running. Central Park West is a really strange case inside that story because it's in the book. A Coltrane ballad with this much harmonic reputation among musicians is always going to get photocopied. But it doesn't show up in either of the lists, and I'd guess it's not on most cities' lists. It never survived by getting called often enough in somebody's room the way Beautiful Love or Dinah did. It survived on paper. It survived because it was printed, studied, and occasionally performed by musicians specifically drawn to its technical harmonies. Almost never called by somebody at a jam who just wants to play a pretty ballad and move on to the next tune. That's a different kind of survival, and it's the reason I picked this tune out of the whole book this week. We'll come back to that at the end of the hour. Every city I can think of has its own version of these two lists, and almost nobody ever writes theirs down because you don't need to. You just show up on the right night and you absorb it, which means the printed canon and the actual living canon have always been two different things running alongside each other. The real book is the one visitors and students meet first. The unwritten list is the one that tells you whether you've actually spent time in a city's jazz scene or if you're just passing through. The Yardbird itself is a physical argument for this. Almost 70 years running now, which makes it one of the longest continuously operating jazz clubs anywhere in the country. And every one of those years added another layer to what gets called on a given night. Nobody voted on A Beautiful Love or There Will Never Be Another You becoming house tunes. It just keeps getting called by whoever was leading the session until the room itself expects to hear them. Coltrane recorded Central Park West at Atlantic Studios in New York on October 24th of 1960 in the middle of a six-day stretch, October 21, 24, and 26, that produced most of Coltrane's sound, All of My Favorite Things, and a chunk of what would eventually surface as Coltrane Plays the Blues. It is, by sheer volume of usable material, the single most productive week Coltrane ever had in a recording studio, and it happened at a point where he was already thinking past the label he was recording for. By the time the tapes were made, Coltrane was already signed to Impulse Records. It was a bigger contract, more creative latitude, the beginning of a phase of his career most listeners know best. Atlantic, left holding a stack of unreleased material from an artist that was no longer theirs, held Central Park West back for 4 years, then assembled it into Coltrane Sound and released it in the summer of 1964. It is one of several posthumous feeling releases the label drew from with its Coltrane Volt as his reputation grew through the decade, packaged and sequenced without his direct involvement. The same pattern Prestige and Blue Note had already run with older Coltrane material they still owned. By 1964, Coltrane had already moved through Africa Brass and Ballads and was less than a year away from Love Supreme. The listening public heard Central Park West as new music from an artist who'd already changed twice since he'd actually played it. The initial reception to the album was modest. It was reviewed at the time as just one more posthumous Vault Atlantic release, riding Coltrane's Impulse era reputation, not a standalone event in its own right. Its afterlife as a serious harmonic document amongst musicians came later, and it came slowly, mostly through people who sat down with the lead sheet and worked the changes themselves than people who'd simply heard it on the radio. That slow, studious kind of transmission, the piece finding its audience among musicians willing to sit with a difficult 10 bars rather than amongst casual listeners, turns out to be the whole story of how this tune has survived, right up through tonight's 5 versions. Coltrane's own catalog makes the point almost by accident. He recorded dozens of originals across his career, and only a small handful ever became tunes that other musicians reach for, the way they reach for Ellington or Monk, Giant Steps, Impressions, Naima. Central Park West sat well outside that first tier for decades, known mostly to players specifically chasing his harmonic language, rather than to anyone looking for just another pretty ballad to blow. Most episodes of this show get a moment where somebody other than the composer took a tune and made it definitive, but it's not true with this one. Coltrane wrote Central Park West, Coltrane recorded it once, and the recording he made is still the reference point every later version measures itself against. There is no second act where a bigger star discovered it and ran off with it. Here's John Coltrane's Central Park West in full, from the album called Coltrane Sound, from Atlantic Records, 1964. That's John Coltrane on soprano saxophone, McCoy Tyner piano, Steve Davis on the bass, Elvin Jones on drums. Thank you. Tyner is 21 years old on this date, and he's already working out the block chords and the chordal voicings, chords built on fourths rather than thirds, that would define his sound for the next decade and become one of the most imitated piano languages in jazz. His two-chorus solo here moves through Coltrane's four key centers with a harmonic confluence that belies how new this material was to everyone in the room, Coltrane included. This was, after all, a chord cycle nobody had ever played before this session, worked out on the page and then tested live on the tape. Elvin Jones, capable of a more sustained force behind a drum kit than almost anyone else in the era, plays this one all the way down, restraint as its own kind of control. A drummer known for generating weather, choosing instead to barely stir the air. Steve Davis, the least documented member of Coltrane's turn-of-the-decade rhythm sections, he'd been gone from the band within a year, replaced by Reggie Workman and then Jimmy Garrison. He holds the bottom with a mostly stepwise line that tracks the harmony without ever fighting you for its attention. The soprano itself is the arrangement choice that matters the most. Coltrane had owned the horn for about 7 months by this session, and its brighter, narrower voice does something a tenor might not have managed to do as cleanly. It draws a line through the set of chord changes that would otherwise turn muddy at a ballad tempo, the way a pencil line stays legible where a brushstroke blurs. The tune became and remains a favorite amongst musicians for a specific reason. It proves that Coltrane's symmetrical, cyclic, harmonic thinking wasn't limited to burners like Giant Steps or Countdown, tunes built for speed and for technical display. It also worked as a whisper on an instrument he'd barely had time to learn. Every musician who's covered it since has to solve the same problem Coltrane solved once. Cold, in a single studio session. How to sound lyrical over harmonic ground that keeps quietly sliding out from under you four times in a chorus in a form almost over before it starts. Atlantic's four-year delay meant this recording eventually reached listeners twice, first on Coltrane Sound in 1964 and then again in 1970, folded into the label's posthumous compilation called The Best of John Coltrane, released just months after his death and sequenced alongside Giant Steps and Naima as though it belonged to the same moment. They don't quite. Giant Steps and Naima are both 1959, Central Park West is 1960, but the compilation's instinct to group them isn't wrong. All three come from the same 18-month stretch where Coltrane is working it out in three different tempos and moods. What a personal harmony. One name worth putting on record here, since he shaped this whole session without ever touching an instrument, is the producer, Nishui Etterian, Atlantic's head of jazz A&R throughout this entire period, who kept booking Coltrane into the studio through those prolific Atlantic years, even as the material piled up faster than the label could actually release it. Without that stockpiling, there's no 4 years later Coltrane sound and no Central Park West as we know it. It might simply have stayed on an unreleased session tape, the way of other 1960s Atlantic material eventually did. You are listening to The Standard Show here on Biggie Radio in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I'm Johanna Lean, your host, and you can find versions that we didn't have time to play here tonight on the website. That's the-standard-show.com. Here's a great redemption record. Tommy Flanagan, piano, with George Mraz, bass, and Al Foster on the drums, from Giant Steps, in memory of John Coltrane, recorded February 17 and 18th of 1982 at Eurosound in New York, released on the Enya label. Central Park West runs 5 minutes and 34 seconds, opening with Flanagan alone before Mraz enters with a counter melody threaded through the harmony. Flanagan was actually the pianist in Coltrane's original 1959 Giant Steps session, and this 1982 trio record, named after the very tune on purpose, is him going back through Coltrane's whole songbook 23 years later. In May of 1959, Coltrane brought Flanagan into the studio to record the title track of what would later become Giant Steps. Flanagan had only rehearsed the tune at a slow tempo beforehand, and by his own later account and multiple historians retelling, believed that the tune was a ballad. When Coltrane counted off the real take at full speed, Flanagan was caught off guard. His solo on the release master is the halting, searching one that it's been written about for decades as a pianist getting outrun by the changes in real time. 23 years later, Flanagan made an entire trio album of Coltrane's compositions and named it Giant Steps on purpose. By the time he gets to Central Park West, there's no hesitation anywhere in his playing. Just a musician who went back and settled a score with a tune that once got the better of him. Before we get into this next one, I'm going to mention that the vocal group called the Four Freshmen also recorded Central Park West a cappella on their 2015 live album called Four Freshmen and Friends. They mention sights in Central Park in the head, and then it's a wordless harmony piece standing in for the for Coltrane's soprano line. It has no lyric at all. One critic reviewing that record for Jazz Times called it lovely, but then said it was a shame that the group hadn't used someone else's lyric and something that somebody had already written for the tune. That somebody is who we're about to hear. You know that I love Jose James. I've mentioned him in previous episodes. This is Jose James with Nori Ochai, Alex David on bass, Luke DeMarche on drums, music by Coltrane, lyrics by James himself from The Dreamer, 10th anniversary edition, released March 16, 2018.
Baby, please.
Actually Jose James' origin story. James actually wrote and recorded this in 2006 as part of a demo that also included his own lyrics to Equinox and Resolution. He carried copies to a UK jazz competition. One reached producer Giles Peterson, and that demo is what got James signed to Brownswood Recordings in the first place. It isn't just a cover he picked up later. It is really the reason for his whole career. This recording only existed streaming on James' own website, and you couldn't buy it on a CD. It didn't get proper release until his 2018 anniversary reissue folded it into his debut album, more than a decade after he wrote it. Even a lyric, once it exists, apparently has to wait its turn to become the official.
Falling, the wise old moon.
sweet new love. I'm dreaming fall in love, fall in love, fall in love, dream and fall in
This is Brooklyn Ragamuffin from the album Coltrane Ragga Tribute. It was released June 23, 2017, recorded live at Pioneer Works in Red Hook, Brooklyn on October 11, 2015, timed to Coltrane's birthday and broadcast by Columbia's WKCR. Swapping the soprano saxophone for a bamboo flute and adding harp is about as far as this tune's texture has ever traveled from Atlantic Studios, and it isn't just a novelty pairing. The real history is that Coltrane met Ravi Shankar in New York around 61 or 62, and Alice Coltrane spent the rest of her career building her own ragga-influenced spiritual jazz on that same foundation. The couple later named their son Ravi. Brooklyn Ragamuffin frames the whole album as a continuation of that specific lineage, and Central Park West, already the gentlest, most meditative tune in Coltrane's book, sits amongst their versions of Africa, India, and Alabama as the quietest entry point into it. Thank you. Central Park West sits in the Real Book, Volume 1, Hal Leonard's sixth legal edition in the C section. It's three tunes after Can't Help Lovin' That Man and three before Chega de Saudade on page 69. There is no real folklore attached to how it got in. A Coltrane ballad with this much harmonic reputation amongst musicians was always going to make the cut. The chart runs the full 10-bar form in B major, Coltrane's own compact four-key cycle. It's not the sprawling harmony of Giant Steps or Countdown. That short form is exactly why it's a different kind of hard at a jam. At barely a third of the length of a standard 32-bar tune, choruses go by really fast in a round robin, so it rewards having the changes fully memorized before you call it. There isn't time to read them off the page and still find the turnaround. The B-flat and the E-flat transposed editions carry the identical form and key relationships, just shifted for the instrument, so the short form challenge is the same, no matter which horn is calling it. For most of the last 65 years, Central Park West has lived on paper and in scholarship more than in performance. The Washington, D.C. saxophonist and multi-instrumentalist Andrew White, who died in 2020, spent nearly 50 years running his own label, Andrew's Music, out of his own house. More than 40 self-released albums, alongside a scholarly project almost nobody else has ever attempted, which is to transcribe and publish over 800 of Coltrane's recorded solos by hand, note for note, including this one. White is part of this tune story not because he made it famous in any room. He was famous almost defiantly outside of the commercial jazz industry his entire career. But because he's exactly the kind of devoted, obsessive documentarian this piece has depended on to stay findable at all, that's a different kind of survival than something like Beautiful Love that you get in a standard jam. And that's the kind of dedication that has kept Central Park West alive. And that brings us to the freshest version I could find, and about as far from Manhattan as this tune has ever traveled. Danish saxophonist Niels Vincentes and American pianist Danny Grislet released Nostalgia in Vienna on August 2nd, 2024. That's just two instruments, that's saxophone and piano. No bass, no drums. The entire four-key cycle held up by two people instead of four. 64 years and an ocean away from the room where it started. It's also worth saying plainly, apps like Ido Pro, the play-along software most musicians actually practice with these days, generally take their changes straight from the print editions, like the Real Book, rather than from the original recordings. Whatever this chart gets right or wrong sits there permanently, copied into a new generation's practice routine in a city near you without necessarily checking it against the tape. You can go in and edit your own edition, but it doesn't cause that global ripple that the Real Book traditionally had on the jazz canon. And that's the Real Book's power in miniature. Not just what you put in the canon in the 1970s, but what keeps quietly reteaching every year since. Neither of my two lists, not from Room in New Orleans and not from the Yardbird Suite on a Tuesday, have I ever heard this tune called. It got into the canon in a different way, not by surviving in anyone's ear, but by surviving on paper, long enough for scholars and devotees, one generation after the next, to keep finding it there and deciding it was worth the trouble. And somewhere in a room in New Orleans tonight, and somewhere at the Yardbird Suite on a Tuesday, neither list will change one bit, which is exactly as it should be, since a jam session was never supposed to be. That's the standard show for this week. The tune was Central Park West by John Coltrane. You can always find full versions, all the performances, plus playlists for iTunes and YouTube by going to the website. That's the-standard-show.com. And until then, I leave you with this version by the Glenn Zaleski Trio, their version of Central Park West. And until then, I'll see you next week.